Chapter 6 Chancellorsville and Gettysburg. The spring of 1863 found the Army of the Potomac and the Army of Northern Virginia still facing each other across the Rappahannock. Hooker, Fighting Joe, had distinguished himself as a corps commander at the Antietam. He was not the next senior and had intrigued against his chief. He owed his present advancement to Lincoln, who knew him to be a good fighter and hoped the best of him as a commander. The obvious course, to restore McClellan again, was politically impossible and would have weakened the president's authority. At the end of January, when he was appointed, Hooker found the Federal Army in a sorry plight, which his own previous discontent had fomented. More than 3,000 officers and 80,000 men were either deserters or absent with or without leave. Blows like Fredericksburg are hard to sustain. It was not till April that reorganization was complete. Reinforcements had poured in, and the absentees had returned from their Christmas at home. He was now at the head of over 130,000 men, rested and revived, splendidly equipped, and organized in 6 Army Corps. He formed, besides, a cavalry corps 10,000 strong, and he felt himself able to declare that he led the finest army on the planet. In meeting the offensive, which he knew must come, Lee was gravely hampered by President Davis's policy of the strict defensive and the dispersal of the Confederate troops to cover a number of places. The continued pressure of the war rendered the defense of the ports of Wilmington and Charleston in South Carolina of vital importance, though only blockade runners could enter them. They, and the railways connecting them with Richmond, were threatened in the president's eyes by the somewhat near presence of federal forces which had been landed in March 1862 at New Bern in North Carolina, and others which had advanced to Suffolk in the estuary of the James River and only 75 miles from Richmond. These parties, owing to the nature of the ground near the coast, had been dealt with by local forces. But Lee, also bearing in mind the difficulty of feeding his troops near the Rappahannock, sent first one, then a second and third detachment under Longstreet to deal with them. It was one of Lee's mistakes. Longstreet, who was always striving for an independent command, unnecessarily sat down to besiege Suffolk. Thus Lee's 9 divisions were reduced by 3, and 2 of his 4 cavalry brigades were south of the James to gather forage. His infantry was less than half, and his cavalry a quarter of the forces he had to encounter. He therefore abandoned the idea of an offensive into Pennsylvania by way of the Shenandoah Valley, which he had had in mind, and awaited events. Hooker's preponderance enabled him to act with 2 armies. His plan was, first, a fortnight in advance of the main move to send his cavalry round Lee's left by the upper fords of the Rappahannock, then, to turn Lee's left with 3 corps, while the 2 others, under General John Sedgwick, crossed the river below Lee's right at Fredericksburg. Even then, he had another corps in reserve. He expected that Lee would be forced to abandon his lines and retreat, in which case he meant to follow him up the direct road to Richmond. In the middle of April, these movements began. The Federal Cavalry Corps, under a second-rate commander, General George Stoneman, was delayed by floods, and only crossed the upper Rappahannock simultaneously with the right column of the main army. At first, all went well with Hooker. His 3 Army Corps, about 70,000 strong, crossed the Rappahannock, and on the morning of April the 30th, its tributary, the Rapidan. As they marched eastward, they took, in flank and rear, the fortified line which Lee had formed. The Confederates, guarding United States Ford on the Rappahannock, had to retire, and the reserve Federal Corps passed over unmolested. By the night of the 30th, a Federal army of 90,000 men was concentrated at or near Chancellorsville, behind all these defenses. The Federal cavalry, in enormous, though not, as it proved, overwhelming strength, were already moving towards the Virginia Central Railway, 45 miles in rear of Lee's army, and one of his main lines of supply, which it was their mission not only to cut, but to destroy. At the same time, General Sedgwick, commanding the 2 corps opposite Fredericksburg, crossed the river and deployed to attack Jackson's three divisions under General Jubal A. Early, which held the old trenches of the former battle. Lee was thus taken in pincers by two armies, each capable of fighting a major battle with him, while at the same time his rear was ravaged and his communications assailed. The advance of either Federal army would render his position untenable, and their junction or simultaneous action in a single battle must destroy him. Nothing more hopeless on the map than his position on the night of the 30th can be imagined, and it is this which raises the event which followed from a military to an historic level. The great commander and his trusty lieutenant remained crouched but confident amid this tremendous encirclement. Beset upon both flanks by hostile armies, which were for the moment disconnected and unable to retreat without yielding vital positions, Lee naturally sought to hold off one assailant while striking at the other. Which to choose? Jackson was for falling upon Sedgwick and driving him into the river, but Lee knew that nothing less than the defeat of the main Union army would save him. Hooker had taken command in person of this mighty array, and Lee, as soon as he learned where he was, left only a division to delay Sedgwick and marched at once to attack him. Meanwhile, Jeb Stuart manoeuvred against Stoneman's cavalry over a wide front to such good purpose that, though he was outnumbered by 4-1, he was able to render perfect service to Lee, while the Federal cavalry general Stoneman played no part in the battle. Chancellorsville stands on the edge of a wild region of forest and tangled scrub, which still deserves the name of wilderness. Roads or paths cut through this alone rendered movement possible. On May the 1st, Hooker, having brought up all his troops, ordered a general advance eastward along the Turnpike and the Plank Road. His numerous cavalry were breaking up the Virginia Central Railway at Louisa Courthouse, 30 miles to the southward. He had three balloons and numerous signal stations, and even a field electric telegraph for communication with Sedgwick. But the mist of the morning lay in fog banks over the valley of the Rappahannock. The balloons and signal stations could see nothing, and the electric telegraph broke down. As he advanced into the wilderness, he met large enemy forces, who began at once to attack him. These were Stonewall Jackson's corps, handled with its general's usual vigor. Now, Fighting Joe, so famous as a subordinate, bent under the strain of supreme command. He'd expected that his well-executed strategy would compel Lee to retreat. He now conceived himself about to be attacked by the whole Confederate army. He turned at once and fell back upon the entrenched line he'd already prudently prepared before Chancellorsville. It was late in the afternoon of the 1st when the advancing Confederates, emerging from the woodland, came within sight of this formidable position with its masses of troops. All the time, Sedgwick at Fredericksburg, receiving no orders by the electric telegraph and baffled by Early's brave show on the fatal heights already dyed with Union blood, although he heard the firing, made no effort. How did he know that Longstreet might not have arrived, as would indeed have been only proper? Thus the night set in. Lee and Jackson sat together and knew that they had one day before them. Unless they could beat Hooker at odds of 2-1 during May the 2nd, they would be attacked front and rear by overwhelming forces. Frontal attack was impossible. Their only chance was to divide their small army and swing round Hooker's right. Search had been made for a road or track for such a movement, and in the small hours one of Jackson's staff officers reported that there was a private road used for hauling wood and ore to a furnace which would serve. Jackson at once proposed to lead his whole corps along it, and Lee, after a moment's reflection, assented. This meant that Jackson, with 26,000 men, would march round Hooker's right to attack him, while Lee faced nearly 80,000 Federals with 17,000. At 4 a.m., Jackson was on the march. It seemed vital that his movement should be unperceived, but an unexpected gap in the forest revealed, about 8 o'clock, to the Federal troops at Hazel Grove, a long column moving towards the right of their wide front. This exposure actually helped the Confederate maneuver. Two divisions of General Daniel E. Sickles' corps advanced after some delay to strike at these processionists and find out their purpose. They came into contact with Jackson's rearguard, who fought stubbornly and then vanished in the woods. The two divisions, now joined by Sickles himself, feeling they had a retreating enemy before them, pushed on hopefully, and Sickles thought he'd cut the Confederate army in twain. This was indeed true. Lee and Jackson were now separated, and only victory could reunite them. Had Hooker set his army in motion against Lee, he must have driven Lee ever farther from Jackson and ever nearer to Sedgwick, who had now at length forced the heights of Fredericksburg and, little more than 8 miles away, was, with 30,000 men, driving Early back upon Lee's rear. But Hooker, convinced that he was safe within his fortifications and that his strategy was successful, made no move while the hours slipped away. It was 6 o'clock in the evening before Jackson reached the end of his march. He'd not only turned Hooker's flank, but was actually in rear of his right-hand corps. He deployed into line, facing Lee about 4 miles away on the other side of the Federal Army. The surprise was complete. The soldiers of the 11th Federal Corps were eating their supper and playing cards behind their defences when suddenly there burst from the forest at their backs the Confederate line of battle. In 1 hour, the 11th Corps, attacked by superior forces in this battle, although as a whole their army was 2-1, was dashed into rout and ruin. Night was falling, but Jackson saw supreme opportunity before him. He was within half a mile of the road leading to United States Ford, the sole line of retreat for Hooker's whole army, and between him and this deadly thrust, no organized force intervened. He selected the point which he must gain by night and hold to the death at dawn. The prize was nothing less than the destruction of the main Federal army. They must either overwhelm him the next day or starve between the Wilderness and his cannon. All this he saw. He rode forward with a handful of officers along the plank road to the skirmish line to see what he could of the ground. He'd often risked his life in this way, and now the forfeit was claimed. As he returned, his own men, Carolinians proud to die at his command, mistaking in the darkness the small party for hostile cavalry, fired a volley. 3 bullets pierced the general's left arm and shoulder. He fell from his horse, and when, after an agonizing passage, he reached the field hospital, he was too much weakened by loss of blood to concentrate his mind. His staff officer, who was to lead A.P. Hill's division to the vital point, had been killed by the same volley. Hill, on whom the command devolved, hastening forward after vainly questioning his swooning chief, was almost immediately himself wounded. It was some hours before Stuart, from the cavalry, could be brought to the scene. No one knew Jackson's plan, and he was now unconscious. Thus, on small agate points, do the balances of the world turn. Stuart fought a fine battle during the night, and on May the 3rd, with wild shouts of "Remember Jackson," the infuriated Confederates assaulted the Federal line. They drove it back. They captured Hazel Grove. They joined hands again with Lee. But the chance of the night was gone forever. Hooker now had masses of men covering his line of retreat. He now thought of nothing but retreat. He did not even keep Lee occupied upon his front. He was morally beaten on the 2nd, and during the battle of the 3rd, a solid shot hitting the pillar of a house by which he stood stunned him, which was perhaps a merciful stroke. Lee now turned on Sedgwick, whose position south of the river was one of great peril. He'd fought hard during the whole of the 3rd, and found himself on the 4th, with the river at his back, and only 20,000 effective men, attacked by Lee with at least 25,000. But the Confederate soldiers were exhausted by their superhuman exertions. Sedgwick, though beaten and mauled, managed to escape by his pontoons at Fredericksburg. Here he was soon joined by the commander-in-chief and the rest of the magnificent army, which 9 days before had seemed to have certain success in their path, but now stood baffled and humbled at their starting point. They were still twice as numerous as their opponents. They'd lost 17,000 men out of 130,000, and the Confederates 12,500 out of 60,000. Chancellorsville was the finest battle which Lee and Jackson fought together. Their combination had become perfect.
"Such an executive officer," said Lee, "the sun never shone on. Straight as the needle to the pole, he advances to the execution of my purpose."
"I would follow General Lee blindfold," is a remark attributed to Jackson. Now all was over.
"Could I have directed events," wrote Lee, ascribing the glory to his stricken comrade, "I should have chosen for the good of the country to be disabled in your stead."
Jackson lingered for a week. His arm was amputated. Pneumonia supervened. On the 10th he was told to prepare for death, to which he consented with surprise and fortitude.
"Very good, very good. It is all right."
Finally, after some hours, quietly and clearly,
"Let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of the trees."
His loss was a mortal blow to Lee and to the cause of the South. Nevertheless, in these months, the scales of war seemed to turn against the Union. A wave of discouragement swept across the North. Desertion was rife in the Federal ranks. Conscription, called the draft, was violently resisted in many states. Many troops had to be withdrawn from the front to enforce the law. Many hundreds of lives were lost in New York City in the draft riots. Clement L. Valentine, the leader of the Peace Party, or Copperheads as they were called, after a particularly poisonous snake, declared in Congress,
"You have not conquered the South, you never will.
Money you have expended without limit, blood poured out like water. Defeat, death, taxation, and sepulchres, these are your only trophies." The legislatures of Indiana and Illinois threatened to acknowledge the Confederacy. "Everybody feels," wrote Medill, the editor of the Chicago Tribune and a close friend of the president's, "that the war is drawing to a disastrous and disgraceful termination. Money cannot be supplied much longer to a beaten democracy and homesick army." It was indeed the darkest hour. But the heart of Lincoln did not fail him. Problems on the seas and across the ocean also perplexed and agitated the North. The small Confederate navy was active and successful in the Gulf of Mexico and on the Atlantic coast. On the high seas, Confederate commerce raiders, built in Britain, were taking a heavy toll of northern shipping. The most famous of them, the Alabama, had stolen out of the River Mersey in June 1862. She sailed under a false name and in spite of the protests of the American minister in London. After a glorious career, lasting 2 years, she was brought to bay by a federal cruiser in the English Channel. A gallant engagement was fought off Cherbourg. It was witnessed by a number of French artists, one of whom, Manet, has left a remarkable painting of the scene. The Alabama was outgunned and sunk. The federal government pressed Britain hard for compensation for the damage done by the southern raiders. Negotiations were long and disputatious. They were not concluded until 6 years after the end of the war, when Gladstone's government agreed to pay the United States $15 million. Throughout the spring and summer of 1863, anxiety grew in Washington because of the building in the British yard which had launched the Alabama of two new ironclad Confederate warships. They were fitted with 9-inch rifled guns and formidable underwater rams, thus combining the offensive merits of the Merrimack and the Monitor. These ships were known as the Laird Rams, after their builders. The American minister bombarded the Foreign Secretary, Lord John Russell, with demands that the Laird Rams must not be allowed to escape, as the Alabama had done. Russell eventually realized that the construction of such vessels by neutral would set a bad precedent which might work to Britain's disadvantage in future wars. In September, he ordered their seizure. Thus was closed the last of the wartime diplomatic crises between Britain and the Union. The initiative in the field now passed to Lee, who resolved to carry out his long-planned invasion of Pennsylvania. But Vicksburg on the Mississippi was in dire straits, and unless Joseph E. Johnston could be largely reinforced, its fall was imminent. A proposal was made to stand on the defensive in Virginia, to send Lee himself with Longstreet's two divisions to the Mississippi, and other troops to Middle Tennessee, to defeat the covering forces under Rosecrans south of Nashville, and threaten the commercial cities of Louisville and Cincinnati, perhaps forcing Grant to abandon his campaign against Vicksburg. Lee refused point-blank to go. Squarely, he put the issue before the Council of War. The risk had to be taken of losing Mississippi or Virginia. His view prevailed, and on May the 26th, 3 weeks after Chancellorsville, the invasion of Pennsylvania was sanctioned. The Army of Northern Virginia was reorganized in three corps of three divisions each, commanded by Longstreet, Richard S. Ewell, and A.P. Hill. Lee's object in 1863, as in the previous year, was to force the Army of the Potomac to fight under conditions in which defeat would spell annihilation. In this, he saw the sole hope of winning Southern independence. The movement commenced on June the 3rd. Longstreet concentrated his corps at Culpeper, and behind it, the other two corps passed into the Shenandoah Valley, marching straight for the Potomac. Longstreet meanwhile moved up on the east of the Blue Ridge with his front and flank screened by Stuart's cavalry, eventually entering the valley behind the other two corps through the northern gaps. On the 9th, before the movement was well underway, there was an indecisive cavalry battle at Brandy Station, in which the Federal cavalry, under their new commander, Alfred Pleasanton, regained their morale. At first, the campaign went well for Lee. Ewell, on the 10th, left Culpeper for the valley, and, marching with a speed worthy of Stonewall Jackson, cleared the Federal garrisons out of Winchester and Martinsburg, capturing 4,000 prisoners and 28 guns, and on the 15th was crossing the Potomac. He established his corps at Hagerstown, where it waited for a week till the corps in the rear was ready to cross, and his cavalry brigade pushed on to Chambersburg in Pennsylvania to collect and send back supplies. On the 22nd, he was ordered to advance farther into Pennsylvania and capture Harrisburg, 100 miles north of Washington, if it came within his means. On the 27th, Ewell reached Carlisle, and his outposts next day were within 4 miles of Harrisburg. The other two Confederate corps were at Chambersburg. As far as Chambersburg, Lee had been following the Cumberland Valley, with his right flank shielded by the South Mountain Range, and as yet he knew nothing of Hooker's movements. He accepted Stuart's plan of making a raid through the mountains and joining Ewell in Pennsylvania. Stuart, who started on the 25th, believed that Hooker was still in his encampments on the east side of the mountains, and expected to be able to ride through his camp areas and cross the Potomac near Leesburg. But Hooker had broken up his camps and was marching that same morning for the Potomac. Stuart had to make a third ride round the Federal rear, cross the Potomac within 20 miles of Washington, fail to make contact with Ewell's right division, and only rejoined Lee with his men and horses, utterly exhausted, on the afternoon of July the 2nd. Thus, for a whole week, Lee had been deprived of the eyes of his army, and much had happened meanwhile. As soon as Lee began his movement to the north, Hooker proposed to march on Richmond. But Lincoln forbade him, and rightly pointed out that not Richmond, but Lee's army was his proper objective. In thus deciding, the president did what Lee had expected. After crossing the Potomac, Hooker made his headquarters near Frederick, where he covered Washington and threatened Lee's line of communications. Halleck and Stanton had agreed after Chancellorsville that Hooker must not be in command of the army in the next battle. When, therefore, the general, denied the use of the Harper's Ferry garrison, tendered his resignation, it was promptly accepted. Early in the morning of June the 28th, General George G. Meade, commander of the Fifth Corps, who was now appointed to the chief command, decided to move his whole army by forced marches northwards to the Susquehanna to prevent Lee from crossing that river, and at the same time to cover Baltimore and Washington. Meade was a safe, dogged commander with no political affiliations. He could be relied upon to avoid acts of folly, and also anything brilliant. Expecting that Lee would come south from the Susquehanna to attack Baltimore, he now prepared to meet him on the line of Pipe Creek, 10 miles beyond Westminster. Lee had been greatly perplexed by Stuart's failure to report, but, having implicit confidence in him, had concluded that Hooker must still be south of the Potomac. On learning the truth during the 28th, he ordered a concentration at Cashtown, close to the eastern foot of South Mountain. He did not hurry, and the march was conducted with a view to the comfort of the troops. At the outset of the campaign, he'd been in agreement with Longstreet that the strategy should be offensive, and the tactics defensive, and he had no intention of fighting a battle except under favourable conditions. But chance ruled otherwise. On June the 30th, a brigade of Hill's Corps advanced 8 miles from Cashtown to Gettysburg, partly to look for shoes, partly to reconnoitre a place through which Ewell's Corps might be moving next day. Gettysburg was found in the hands of some Federal cavalry which had just entered. The Confederate brigade thereupon turned back without ascertaining the strength of the hostile force. Buford, the Federal cavalry commander, who bore the Christian names of Napoleon B., seems to have been the first man in either army to appreciate the strategical importance of Gettysburg, the meeting place of some dozen roads from all points of the compass. He moved his division to the west of the town, where he found a strong position behind a stream, and called upon the commander of the First Corps to come to his aid with all speed. The First Corps was followed by the 11th Corps. On July the 1st, severe fighting began with the leading Confederate troops, and presently Ewell, coming down from the northeast, struck in upon the Federal flank, driving the 11th Corps through Gettysburg to seek shelter on higher ground 3 miles southwards, well named Cemetery Ridge. On this first day of battle, 50,000 men had been engaged, and 4 Confederate divisions had defeated and seriously injured 2 Federal Corps. It now became a race between Lee and Meade, who could concentrate his forces first. Neither Lee nor Meade wished to fight decisively at this moment or on this ground, but they were both drawn into the greatest and bloodiest battle of the Civil War. Lee could not extricate himself and his supply trains without fighting Meade's army to a standstill, and Meade was equally committed to a field he thought ill-chosen. Lee wished to open the second day of the battle with an attack by Ewell and Hill on Cemetery Ridge, which he rightly regarded as the key to the Federal position. He was deterred by their objections. Longstreet, when he arrived, argued at length for a manoeuvre round Meade's left to place Lee's army between Meade and Washington. Such a movement in the absence of Stuart's cavalry would certainly have been reckless, and it is not easy to see how Lee could have provisioned his army in such a position. Finally, Lee formally ordered Longstreet to attack the Federal left at dawn. Longstreet, who entirely disapproved of the role assigned to him, did not come into action till 4 in the afternoon. While he waited for an additional brigade, 2 corps joined the Union army. Lee, who imagined that the Federal left rested upon the Emmitsburg Road, expected that Longstreet's advance up this road would roll up the Federal line from left to right. But at this point, the Federal Corps commander, Sickles, had taken up an advanced position on his own authority, and his flank was not the end of the Federal line. When this was discovered, Longstreet obstinately refused to depart from the strict letter of his orders, though he knew that Lee was not aware of the true position. All that he achieved after several hours' fierce fighting was to force Sickles back to Meade's main line. On this day, the greater part of Hill's Corps took no part in the battle. Ewell, who was to have attacked the north end of the ridge as soon as he heard Longstreet's guns, did not get into action till 6 p.m. There were no signs of any coordination of attacks on the Confederate side on July the 2nd. Although Lee had failed to make his will prevail, and the Confederate attacks had been unconnected, the losses of the Federal army were terrible, and Meade, at the Council of War that night, was narrowly dissuaded from ordering a general retreat. The third day began. Lee still bid high for victory. he resolved to launch 15,000 men, sustained by the fire of 125 guns, against Meade's left centre, at the point where one of Hill's brigades had pierced the day before. Ewell's corps would at the same time attack from the north, and if the assault under General George E. Pickett broke the Federal line, the whole Confederate army would fall on. Again, the attack was ordered for the earliest possible hour. It was the Federals, however, who opened the third day by recapturing in the grey of the dawn some of the trenches vacated the previous evening, and after hard fighting drove the Confederates before noon entirely off Culp's Hill. Exhausted by this, Ewell made no further movement. Longstreet was still arguing vehemently in favour of a wide-turning movement round Meade's left. The heavy losses which his corps had suffered on the second made this more difficult than ever. The morning passed in utter silence. It was not till 1 in the afternoon that the Confederates began the heaviest bombardment yet known. Longstreet, unable to rally himself to a plan he deemed disastrous, left it to the artillery commander, Alexander, to give the signal to Pickett. At 2:30, the Confederate ammunition, dragged all the way from Richmond in tented wagons, was running short. "Come immediately," Alexander said to Pickett, "or I cannot give you proper support." "General," said Pickett to Longstreet, who stood somber and mute, "shall I advance?" By an intense effort, Longstreet bowed his head in assent. Pickett saluted and set 42 battalions against the Union centre. We see today, upon this battlefield so piously preserved by North and South, and where many of the guns still stand in their firing stations, the bare, slight slopes up which this grand infantry charge was made. In splendid array, all their battle flags flying, the forlorn assault marched on. But, like the old guard on the evening of Waterloo, they faced odds and mettle beyond the virtue of mortals. The Federal rifled artillery paused till they were within 700 yards. Then they opened again with a roar and cut lanes in the steadfastly advancing ranks. On they went, without flinching or disorder. Then the deadly sound, like tearing paper, as Lee once described it, rose under and presently above the cannonade. But Pickett's division still drove forward, and at trench, stone wall, or rail fence closed with far larger numbers of men, who, if not so lively as themselves, were at least ready to die for their cause. All three brigadiers in Pickett's division fell killed or mortally wounded. General L.A. Armistead, with a few hundred men, actually entered the Union centre, and the spot where he died, with his hand on a captured cannon, is today revered by the manhood of the United States. But where were the reserves to carry through this superb effort? Where were the simultaneous attacks to grip and rock the entire front? Lee at Gettysburg, no more than Napoleon at Waterloo, could win dominance. The victorious stormers were killed or captured. The rest walked home across the corpses which encumbered the plain amid a remorseless artillery fire. Less than a third came back. Lee met them on his horse, Traveller, with the only explanation, which they would not accept: "It is all my fault." Longstreet, in memoirs written long afterwards, has left on record a sentence which is his best defence. "As I rode back to the line of batteries, expecting an immediate counterstroke, the shot and shell ploughed the ground around my horse, and an involuntary appeal went up that one of them would remove me from scenes of such awful responsibility." But there was no counterstroke. The Battle of Gettysburg was at an end. 23,000 Federals and over 20,000 Confederates had been smitten by lead or steel. As, after the Antietam, Lee confronted his foe on the morrow and offered to fight again, but no one knew better that it was decisive. With every personal resource, he gathered up his army. An immense wagon train of wounded were jolted, springless, over 16 miles of crumpled road. "Carry me back to old Virginia. For God's sake, kill me." On the night of the 4th, Lee began his retreat. Meade let him go. The energy for pursuit had been expended in the battle. the Potomac was found in flood. Lee's pontoon bridge had been partially destroyed by a raid from Frederick City. For a week, the Confederates stood at bay behind entrenchments with their backs to an unfordable river. Longstreet would have stayed to court attack, but Lee measured the event. Meade did not appear till the 12th, and his attack was planned for the 14th. When that morning came, Lee, after a cruel night march, was safe on the other side of the river. He carried with him his wounded and his prisoners. He'd lost only two guns and the war. The Washington government were extremely discontented with Meade's inactivity, and not without reason. Napoleon might have made Lee's final attack, but he certainly would not have made Meade's impotent pursuit. Lincoln promoted Meade only to the rank of Major General for his good service at Gettysburg. Lee wended his way back by the Shenandoah Valley to his old stations behind the Rappahannock and the Rapidan. The South had shot its bolt. Up to a certain point, the Gettysburg campaign was admirably conducted by Lee, and some of its objects were achieved. But the defeat with which it ended far more than counterbalanced these. The irreparable loss of 28,000 men in the whole operation out of an army of 75,000 forbade any further attempts to win southern independence by a victory on northern soil. Lee believed that his own army was invincible, and after Chancellorsville he had begun to regard the Army of the Potomac almost with contempt. He failed to distinguish between bad troops and good troops badly led. It was not the army, but its commander that had been beaten on the Rappahannock. It may well be that, had Hooker been allowed to retain his command, Lee might have defeated him a second time. Fortune, which had befriended him at Chancellorsville, now turned against him. Stuart's long absence left him blind as to the enemy's movements at the most critical stage of the campaign, and it was during his absence that he made the fatal mistake of moving to the east side of the mountains. Lee's military genius did not shine. He was disconcerted by Stuart's silence. He was off his balance, and his subordinates became conscious of this mood. Above all, he had not Jackson at his side. Longstreet's recalcitrance had ruined all chance of success at Gettysburg. On Longstreet, the South laid the heavy blame. There was no other battle in the East in 1863, and the armies were left for the winter facing each other on the Rapidan. We must now turn to the West, where great battles were fought and many fell. But since a decisive victory by Lee's army would have enabled him to march where he pleased and to hold New York and every great city of the Atlantic coast to ransom or surrender, this secondary, though spacious, theatre need not be precisely lighted. From the West, it is true, the eventual thrust came which split and devastated the South. But its importance in 1862 and 1863 lay chiefly in the advance of Grant to the supreme unified command of the Union armies. The objective was the clearance or barrage of the Mississippi. In April 1862, Admiral Farragut, a Southerner who adhered to the Union, had become prominent at the head of the Federal Navy. In April, with a fleet of all kinds of vessels, partly armored or naked, he'd run past the forts guarding the approaches to New Orleans, the largest city and the commercial capital of the Confederacy, which fell next day. He had then continued the ascent of the river and reached Vicksburg on May the 18th. Finding no federal troops at hand to support him, he retired to run the batteries again on June the 25th and join hands with the federal flotilla at Memphis. It was therefore known by the end of 1862 that the Confederate batteries could not stop the Union ships. As for the torpedoes, a new word of which there was then much talk, Farragut was to say, "Damn the torpedoes," and be justified. Thenceforward, the Union flotillas could move up and down the great river through its entire course by paying a toll. This was a substantial aid to the Federal army on either bank. Here, in the Mississippi Valley, was almost a separate war. The western states of the Confederacy claimed a great measure of autonomy from Jefferson Davis and his government at Richmond, while clamoring for its help. At Washington, the Western Theater was viewed in much the same way as was the Eastern Front by the Allied and Associated Powers in the First World War. It was secondary, but also indispensable. It was not the path to victory, but unless it was pursued, victory would be long delayed. After the failure of the river expedition in December 1862, Grant reassembled his army on the right bank of the Mississippi. Vicksburg was still his first aim, but the floods of the Yazoo Basin prevented at this season all operations except by water. Having by numerous feints deceived the Confederate General Pemberton, who with a field army was defending Vicksburg, Grant successfully ferried 45,000 men across the Mississippi below the Grand Gulf batteries 36 miles downstream from Vicksburg. He surprised and drove back Pemberton's troops, and on May the 3rd established himself at Grand Gulf in a safe position on the uplands, with his left flank protected by the wide Black River and in touch with the Federal flotillas. Here he was joined, 4 days later, by his third corps under Sherman. He now began a cautious movement towards Vicksburg and the railway which joined it to the town of Jackson. General Joseph E. Johnston, reinforced too late by President Davis, was hurried, ill though he was, to the scene. His only thought now was to extricate Pemberton's army. He ordered that general to march at once to join him before Grant could interpose his three corps between them. Pemberton resolved to disobey this order. He conceived that a movement across Grant's communications with Grand Gulf would compel a federal retreat. He not only disobeyed, he miscalculated. For Grant, like McClellan before Richmond in 1862, with his command of the rivers, was not dependent upon any one particular base. Dropping his links with Grand Gulf, he pressed Johnston back with his right hand, and then turned on Pemberton in great superiority. After a considerable battle at Champion's Hill, in which over 6,000 men fell, Pemberton was driven back into Vicksburg. With the aid of the flotilla, the Union general opened a new base north of the city, and after two attempts to storm its defences, one of which cost him 4,000 men, commenced a regular siege. Large reinforcements presently raised his army to over 70,000 men. Johnston, with 24,000, could do nothing to relieve Pemberton. Vicksburg was starved into surrender, and its Confederate garrison and field army, more than 30,000 strong, capitulated on July the 4th, at the very moment of Lee's defeat at Gettysburg. 5 days later, Port Hudson in Louisiana, also reduced by famine, surrendered with 7,000 men to General Banks, and the whole course of the Mississippi was at last in federal hands. "The Father of Waters," said Lincoln, "again goes unvexed to the sea." These were stunning blows to the South. The main fury of the war was now transferred to the West. Until the fall of Vicksburg was certain, the highly competent Rosecrans, with about 60,000 men, forming the Union Army of the Cumberland, was content from the scene of his success at Murfreesboro to watch Bragg, who stood across the railway line between him and Chattanooga. This city and railway center, protected by the deep and wide Tennessee River on the north and the high ridges of the Appalachian Mountains, a western chain of the Alleghenies, on the south, was the key not only to the mastery of the Mississippi Valley, but to the invasion of prosperous, powerful, and hitherto inviolate Georgia. The waiting period was marked by fierce Confederate cavalry raids to break up the railways behind the Union Army, and by federal counterstrokes against important ironworks and munitions factories in the southern part of Tennessee. In these, the Confederates had the advantage. But when Rosecrans, at the end of June, advanced along the railway to Chattanooga, and Burnside, with another army of 40,000 men 100 miles to the east, struck at Knoxville, great and far-reaching operations were afoot. Burnside captured Knoxville, cutting one of the sinew railways of the Confederacy. Rosecrans maneuvered Bragg out of all his defensive lines astride the Nashville-Chattanooga Railway, and by September the 4th gained Chattanooga without a battle. Until this moment, Rosecrans had shown high strategic skill. He now made the disastrous mistake of supposing that the resolute, agile army in his front was cowed. Bragg, who was one of the worst generals, hated by his lieutenants and nearly always taking the wrong decision, was nonetheless a substantial fighter. South of Chattanooga, the mountain ridges spread out like the fingers of a hand. Bragg lay quiet at Lafayette, with an army now reinforced to 60,000 men. By September the 12th, Rosecrans realized the appalling fact that his three corps were spread on a 60-mile front, and that Bragg lay in their midst three times as strong as any one of them. Bragg, overbearing and ill-served, missed this opportunity, which Lee or Jackson would have made decisive for the whole of the West. Rosecrans recoiled and concentrated towards Chattanooga. But he was too late, even against Bragg, to escape a battle on ground and under conditions far from his choice. At Chickamauga, across the border of Georgia, on September the 18th, Bragg fell upon his enemy. Longstreet from Virginia, with two divisions and artillery, had reached him, together with other heavy reinforcements, so that he had the rare fortune, for a Confederate general, of the weight of numbers behind him. 70,000 Confederates attacked 55,000 Federals. The 2 days' battle was fought with desperate valor on both sides. Bragg tried persistently to turn the Federal left and cut Rosecrans from Chattanooga. But when this wing of the Union Army, commanded by General George H. Thomas, had drawn to its aid troops from the center and right, Longstreet, with 20,000 Virginian veterans, assaulted the denuded parts of the Union front and drove two-thirds of Rosecrans' army, with himself and the corps commanders, except Thomas, in ruin from the field. Longstreet begged Bragg to put all his spare weight behind a left-handed punch, but the commander-in-chief was set upon his first idea. He continued to butt into Thomas, who'd built overnight breastworks of logs and railway iron in the woodland. Night closed upon a scene of carnage surpassed only by Gettysburg. Thomas, the Rock of Chickamauga, extricated himself and his corps and joined the rest of the Federal army in Chattanooga. The casualties in this battle were frightful. 16,000 Federals and over 20,000 Confederates were killed, wounded, or missing. The Confederates, who'd captured 40 guns and the battlefield, and who, for the moment, had broken the enemy's power, had gained the victory. It might have been Ramillies or Waterloo or even Tannenberg. It was Malplaquet. Bragg now blockaded and almost surrounded Rosecrans and the Army of the Cumberland in Chattanooga. He held the two heights which dominated Lookout Mountain and Missionary Ridge. For a time, he barred all supplies by the Tennessee River. In early October, it looked as if the Army of the Cumberland would be starved into surrender. Meanwhile, the position of Burnside at Knoxville, against whom Longstreet had been sent, appeared no less deadly. The Washington government now began to lean heavily upon General Ulysses Grant. His faults and weaknesses were apparent, but so also was his stature. On the Union side, baffled, bewildered, disappointed, weary of bloodshed and expense, Grant now began to loom vast and solid through a red fog. Victory had followed him from Fort Donelson to Vicksburg. Here were large rebel surrenders, troops, cannon, territory. Who else could show the like? On October the 16th, Grant was given command of the departments of the Ohio, Cumberland, and Tennessee rivers, with his lieutenant, Sherman, under him, at the head of the Army of the Tennessee. Rosecrans was dismissed. He'd lost a great battle, and under the Washington administration, no general survived defeat. He had, however, played a distinguished part in the West, and his military record was clean. Long before Chickamauga, he'd lost favor with Halleck. That poor figure, who stood at the portals of the grim politics of these days, who sought to tell the armies what the politicians wanted, and the politicians, as much as they could understand, of the military needs, showed his measure clearly when in February 1863 he wrote to Grant and Rosecrans that the vacant major generalship would be given to whoever won the first notable success. Grant left his letter unanswered. Rosecrans wrote in stern rebuke that a patriot and a man of honour should require no additional incentive to make him do his duty. Thus, when he tripped, he fell on stony ground. By a series of intricate measures, Grant freed the Tennessee River, stormed both Missionary Ridge and Lookout Mountain, and drove Bragg and the Confederate Army in thorough disorder away from Chattanooga. At the same time, he relieved Burnside at Knoxville. The frontiers of the Confederacy rolled southwards in another long lap. Vicksburg had cut it in two along the line of the Mississippi. Chattanooga cut the eastern half again along the range of the Alleghenies. By December 1863, the Confederates were driven back into Georgia, and the whole Mississippi Valley was recovered for the Union. All these convulsive events might have taken a different grip if President Davis had made Lee supreme commander of the Confederate Army after Chancellorsville, or better still, in 1862, and if he had devoted his authority and fine qualities wholly to the task of rallying behind the chief general the loyal, indomitable, but woefully particularist energies of the South. By the end of 1863, all illusions had vanished. The South knew they'd lost the war and would be conquered and flattened. It is one of the enduring glories of the American nation that this made no difference to the Confederate resistance. In the North, where success was certain, they could afford to have bitter division. On the beaten side, the departure of hope left only the resolve to perish arms in hand. Better the complete destruction of the whole generation and the devastation of their enormous land. Better that every farm should be burned, every city bombarded, every fighting man killed, than that history should record that they had yielded. Any man can be trampled down by superior force, and death, in whatever shape it comes, is only death, which comes to all. It might seem incredible when we survey the military consequences of 1863 that the torments of war should have been prolonged through the whole of 1864 and into 1865. "Kill us if you can. Destroy all we have," cried the South. "As you will," replied the steadfast majority of the North.
Chapter 7. The Victory of the Union. The Confederacy was defeated, and the last long phase of the war was one of conquest and subjugation. During the winter of the year which had witnessed Chancellorsville and Gettysburg, Vicksburg, Chattanooga, and Chickamauga, there was a pause. The North gathered its overwhelming strength for a somber task. The war leadership of President Davis was gravely questioned in the South. He'd kept in his own hands not only the enormous business of holding the Confederacy together and managing its political and economic life, but he'd exercised an overriding control upon its military operations. He had obdurately pursued a defensive policy and strategy against odds which nothing but decisive victory in the field could shorten. This had led logically and surely to ruin. Lee and Longstreet were now asked for a general plan for 1864. They proposed that Beauregard, with 20,000 men drawn from the forts in South Carolina, should be joined to Longstreet's army in East Tennessee and, invading Kentucky, strike at the Louisville Railway, the sole line of supply for the main federal army, which was expected to advance southwards from Chattanooga against Joseph E. Johnston. Thereafter, Johnston and all Confederate forces in the West would unite, fighting such battles as might be necessary, in a northward march towards the Ohio. This, they declared, would rupture all federal combinations in the West. As for the East, Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia would be answerable. When this great scheme was laid before Davis at a council of war, Bragg, of all men, pressed an alternative plan, with the result that there was no plan. Johnston must fight as best he could in the West, and Lee would continue to defend Richmond. On March the 9th, President Lincoln appointed Ulysses Grant to the command of all the armies of the United States, raising him to the rank of Lieutenant General. At last, on the northern side, there was unity of command and a general capable of exercising it. Grant's plan was brutal and simple.
It was summed up in the word attrition. In intense fighting and exchange of lives, weight of numbers would prevail. To Meade, who nominally retained the command of the Army of the Potomac, he gave the order, "Wherever Lee goes, there you will go." To Sherman, his friend and brother officer who'd risen with him, he confided the command in the West with similar instructions, but with an addition, "to move against Johnson's army, to break it up, and to get into the interior of the enemy's country as far as you can, inflicting all the damage you can against their war resources." If either Johnston or Lee, profiting by interior lines, showed signs of trying to join the other, no exertion was to be spared to follow him. Grant also ordered three secondary operations, an attack aided by the Navy upon Mobile on the Gulf of Mexico, pressure from Fortress Monroe towards Richmond, and the devastation of the Shenandoah Valley, the granary of the South, and its oft-used route towards Maryland and Washington. Of these diversions, the first two failed, and the Shenandoah plan only succeeded late in the year, when two corps and three cavalry divisions were applied to it under General Philip H. Sheridan. With the approach of spring, Grant, having launched the Union Army, came to grips with Lee on the old battlegrounds of the Rappahannock and the Rapidan, where the traces of Chancellorsville remained and memories of Stonewall Jackson brooded. He took the field at the beginning of May with 120,000 men against Lee with 60,000. He crossed the Rapidan by the fords which Fighting Joe Hooker had used the year before. There, in the savage country of the wilderness, was fought a battle worthy of its field. In 2 days of intricate and ferocious fighting, May the 5th and 6th, Grant was repulsed with the loss of 18,000 men, Lee himself losing about 10,000, the most part in a vehement counterstroke. Grant then passaged to his left, and in a series of confused struggles from the 8th to the 19th, sought to cut the Confederates from their line of retreat upon Richmond. This was called the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse, in which the Federal Army suffered another loss of over 18,000 men, or double that of their opponents. Undeterred by this slaughter, Grant repeated his movement to the left, and prolonged heavy fighting followed in the wild regions of the South Anna Stream, and afterwards on the Pamunkey River. Grant, for all the courage of his men, could never turn Lee's right flank, and Lee and his devoted soldiers could never overcome odds of 2-1. They could only inflict death and wounds in proportion to their numbers. According to Grant's war thought, this process, though costly, had only to be continued long enough to procure the desired result. "I purpose to fight it out on this line," he wrote to Halleck at Washington, "if it takes all summer." But other factors, less arithmetical in their character, imposed themselves. At Cold Harbor, on the ground of the 7 days in 1862, the Federal Commander-in-Chief hurled his army through the blasted, undulating woodland against the haggard, half-starved, but elated Confederate lines. It was at this battle that Lee conversed with the Postmaster General of the Confederacy, who'd ridden out to see the fighting, and asked, "If he breaks your line, what reserve have you?" "Not a regiment," said Lee, "and that has been my condition ever since the fighting commenced. If I shorten my lines to provide a reserve, he will turn me. If I weaken my lines to provide a reserve, he will break them." But the result of the day ended Grant's tactics of unflinching butchery. After 7,000 brave blue-coated soldiers had fallen in an hour or so, the troops refused to renew the assault. More is expected of the high command than determination in thrusting men to their doom. The Union dead and wounded lay between the lines. The dead soon began to stink in the broiling sun. The living screamed for water. But Grant failed to secure a truce for burial and mercy. It was not till the 3rd day after the battle that, upon a letter from Lee saying he would gladly accord it if asked, formal request was made, and for a few hours the firing ceased. During the world wars through which we have lived, no such indulgences were allowed, and numbers dwarfing the scale of the American Civil War perished in no man's land, in long, helpless agony where they fell. But in that comparatively civilized and refined epoch in America, Cold Harbor was deemed a horror almost beyond words. The Army of Northern Virginia had inflicted upon Grant in 30 days a loss equal to its own total strength. He now saw himself compelled to resort to maneuver. He did exactly what McClellan had done on this same ground 2 years earlier. By a skillful and daring march, which Lee was too weak to interrupt, he moved his whole army across the peninsula, and again, using sea power, crossed the James River and established a new base on the south bank. He set himself to attack Richmond by the back door, as McClellan had wished to do. Repulsed at Petersburg, he laid siege, with an army now reinforced to 140,000 men, to the trench lines covering that stronghold and the lines east of Richmond. He failed again to turn Lee's right flank by movements south of the James, and at the end of June resigned himself to trench warfare attack by spade, mine, and cannon. There was no investment, for Lee's western flank remained open. There, static conditions lasted till April 1865. These performances, although they eventually gained their purpose, must be regarded as the negation of generalship. They were, nonetheless, a deadly form of war. Meanwhile, in the West, Sherman, who enjoyed a superiority of almost 2-1, had begun in May to fight his way south along the railway from Chattanooga to Atlanta, deep in Georgia. He was faced by Joseph E. Johnston with 3 strong Confederate corps. A remarkable duel ensued between skillful adversaries. Sherman avoided frontal attacks, and by flanking movements maneuvered Johnston out of one strong position after another. Fierce fighting was continuous on the outpost lines, and in a minor engagement one of Johnston's corps commanders, General Leonidas Polk, was killed by a cannon shot. Only at Kennesaw Mountain did Sherman assault. He was repulsed, with a loss of 2,500 men. But meanwhile, the spectacle of this remorseless advance and his unwillingness to force a battle cost Johnston the confidence of Jefferson Davis. At the moment when he'd resolved to stand at Peachtree Creek, he was superseded by John B. Hood. The Confederate Army, impatient of long retreats, acclaimed the change. But military opinion has always regarded the removal of Johnston as one of the worst mistakes of President Davis in his anxious office. Hood felt himself under obligation to attack, and at Peachtree Creek, Decatur, and East Point, he gave full range to the passion for an offensive which inspired the government he served and the army he led. The Confederates, defending their native soil, hurled themselves against the invader and suffered irreparable losses. At Decatur alone, they lost 10,000 men, without inflicting a third of that loss upon the enemy. After East Point, where 5,000 Confederates fell, both the Army of the West and the Richmond government were convinced that Johnston had probably been right. Hood was directed to return to the defensive, and after some weeks of siege, was driven from Atlanta. In the 4 months' fighting, Sherman had carried the Union flag 150 miles into the Confederacy, with a loss of 32,000 men. The Confederate loss exceeded 35,000.